Right, here we go. Didactic Mind, episode 3. Welcome to all of my regular readers. Welcome to anybody who is new here or who has just stumbled across this track on SoundCloud or has come via my blog. For those of you who are not familiar with me, I am Didact. I write regularly over at Didact's Reach. That's the full name of the blog. didactsreach.blogspot.com. Subscribe to the blog itself to receive regular updates via email. Subscribe to this channel on SoundCloud so that you never miss another upload. And today we are going to talk about mindset and the importance of having the right mindset, or of having a resilient, I should say, mindset to deal with the inevitable shitstorms that will mess you up in life as you go ahead. Now, it should be noted that my advice here is really aimed towards younger men. Most of you guys who have read my work for some time, or those of you who have, you know, seen the world and been in it for a long time, will understand many of the things I'm going to talk about already. So this is not going to be news to you. This is just maybe a different perspective or a slightly different point of view. But you're probably familiar with a lot of what I'm going to say. So what kind of mindset do you need in order to overcome trial and tribulation? Well, you know, the standard manosphere answer for those who have been in the manosphere for a long time says that you need to have a resilient mindset and you need to simply take it on the chin, be stoic, be strong, and get on with conquering what's in front of you. And that's actually excellent advice. I don't have any problem with that advice. And indeed, many of the people who give that advice give it from a place of deep experience. A lot of the guys that I respect, a lot of the guys that I follow, have all said exactly this same thing, that once you cultivate a strong mind and a strong, resilient approach to life, you're going to be okay no matter what hits you. But here's the thing. I've been saying the same thing on my blog since 2013, okay? For 5 years, I preached the exact same gospel. And to be clear, I'm not going to contradict anything that that I just said about having a stoic mindset, having a strong, outwardly focused, and inwardly directed approach to life. None of that is false. All of that is 100% true. My point is that you're going to be tested in ways that you're not prepared for, and nothing can prepare you for them. And you're going to find out in the most painful and difficult ways possible just how unprepared you are for certain challenges to your way of thinking and your way of life. And it's going to become extremely unpleasant. And just when you think it's done, when you think that you know, I've passed the test, it's going to get better from here, it's going to improve, very often you're going to find that, oh crap, you know, it was getting better for a little while and now it's another huge disaster, and I'm in another deep hole and I've got to find a way to dig out of it. And you find a way to dig out of it, and then you realize, wait a second, this is an even bigger, deeper hole that I've got to dig out of here. I can't tell you how many times I've had that exact same thought where, you know, no matter how hard I try over the last year and a half, I just seem to keep getting deeper into trouble. And the reason why this happens, the reason why it's so dangerous is very simple. There's a great movie, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It's called The Replacements, starring Keanu Reeves and Gene Hackman. And it's a movie about an American football team, what the rest of the civilized world calls gridiron, and what the Americans call football, even though it's not played with feet, but that's a whole nother rant. Still, let's be clear, still a vastly more manly and masculine game than soccer, which is, again, the rest of the civilized world, for all of you Yankee rebels out there, is football. That's what the rest of the world correctly calls football. You lot insist on calling it soccer for no earthly reason that any of us can determine. But, you know, that's on you. That's your bloody problem. You'll figure it out, and you let us know when you've done that. Anyway, the movie centers around replacement players who are brought in because a bunch of overpaid Nazi boys decide to go on strike because they're not getting paid enough. And it's a bit uneven. I mean, there's a lot of stupid stuff in the movie. But one of the best scenes in the film is when Keanu Reeves and his team of replacement players are all sitting in the locker room. And Gene Hackman, the head coach, is sitting there with them. And he wants to get them to bond as a team because the previous game that they played, it was a disaster. They lost. But he saw in that game that the quarterback, that played by Keanu Reeves, was actually trying to take charge of a team that wouldn't listen to him and had nothing in common. And he was succeeding, but he got faked out. He lost his mindset towards the very last few minutes of the game, and he was triggered by a memory of something that had happened to him in years past, where he read blitz. He read a blitz play. I have no clue what that means. I don't watch Gridiron. My American friends, I'm sure, will tell me exactly what that means, but he read a blitz pattern, and he reacted in a way that misread the situation. And he, as a result, lost the game for the Washington Sentinels, I think is what the team is called. And Gene Hackman sits all these guys down in a room, and he says to them, okay, we need to talk about our fears. We need to share our fears with one another so that we can bond over them. We can share our fears together and we can conquer them together. Now that we've put it all out in the open, we're no longer afraid of these things because we face them together. And that is a powerful message and a powerful lesson. But the best part of that scene, and if I find it on YouTube, I'll put it in the comments to this video, podcast later on. The best part of that scene is when Keanu Reeves talks about what he's most afraid of, quicksand. He talks about quicksand because he says, you make one mistake, and then you make another mistake, and another, and soon you're drowning. It's like quicksand. The harder you try to fight it, deeper it pulls you in. That is exactly what it is like to make mistakes over and over and over again. You begin to question yourself. When the hard times really start beating on you, you begin to question everything about yourself. You begin to question who you are, whether you're worth anything, what you're going to do with your life, whether the pain you're feeling is ever going to end. And it is brutal and miserable, and there's no getting away from it. You can't turn it around easily or quickly. Jordan Peterson, for whom I used to have a lot of respect, but these days, I mean, I have almost no respect for him whatsoever, wrote about this in 12 Rules for Life, in which he basically tried to come up with a very long-winded comparison between humans and lobsters, where he says that lobsters have a distinct competition-based social hierarchy, and lobsters that win win big and they become more confident through winning. And lobsters that lose become less confident. And this is a fairly obvious but powerful lesson for humans. As it is written, to he who has much, more will be given. And to he who has nothing, even what he has will be taken away. You know, I'm bastardizing scripture a bit, but that's more or less what it says. The context is different, the meaning is a bit different, but the core idea behind those words is the same. When you're confident, when you're winning, it's easy to maintain that momentum. You build momentum. Any athlete in the world, any successful person in the world will tell you that the moment you have serious momentum, it becomes very, very, very difficult to derail you. But eventually something's going to come along and destroy you. Something's going to come along and knock you off your perch. If you take a look at the example of two athletes that I can think of right offhand, Roger Federer and Rich Franklin. Roger Federer is, for those of you who don't follow tennis, the greatest tennis player who has ever picked up a racket. I mean, he simply is. His list of accomplishments is unbelievable. In 2007, he had just finished possibly the most dominant season in the history of men's tennis. He finished the year with, like, I think, 6 or 7 losses. He had won 3 out of the 4 major titles again. He'd gotten his butt kicked at the French Open, but, well, Roland Garros, as it is pretentiously called, but, you know, that was to be expected because Rafael Nadal was at the beginning of his multi-year, more than decade-long reign as the King of Clay. And, you know, Federer, for all of his great strengths in every other aspect of the game, was not and is not a truly deadly clay court player. He's simply the best in the world on fast courts, but on the slower crushed brick courts, not so much. And that's not surprising. I mean, clay court is a whole different realm of play. It's extremely difficult to play, particularly if you're used to grass or hard court, where the ball bounces lower and moves faster. But he finished the 2007 season on top of the world. I mean, he was the greatest. He was on, I think at that point, 12 majors? Yeah, he was on 12 majors that year. And he was doing extremely well. I remember watching him win the 2007 US Open against Novak Djokovic in the final. It's a very close final, but he won in straight sets. And he showed, you know, to everybody just how good he really was. But then 2008 came along, and straight away something was off. Something was not correct with Federer. Something made him slower and less skilled and less capable. And we found out, you know, he started losing tournaments that he would have won with ease. And that carried on all the way through January. He got to the US Open in 2008. He lost a very tight, semifinal? Yeah, I think it was a semifinal. Against Novak Djokovic, again. And he was not playing badly by any means. I mean, he hit a shot that literally he invented out of thin air. It's called an inside-out backhand. And anybody who plays tennis knows that this shot doesn't exist. Nobody else steps around a backhand to hit it inside out, the wrong direction to an opponent's weak side. It just doesn't happen. But that's what he did. But he still lost. And it emerged later on exactly why he lost. He lost because he'd had mononucleosis in the off-season. Mononucleosis is a disease that absolutely destroys your immune system, and, or, well, not immune system exactly, but destroys your stamina and your energy levels. You just want to sleep all the time. You have no strength whatsoever to do anything. People who have had mononucleosis, you know, end up sleeping for most of the day and don't even have the energy to brush their teeth in the morning. That's how much strain he was under. Obviously, he recovered very quickly, but it had an effect on his game. And that, I think, shook his confidence a bit. And again, remember, this was the greatest tennis player, is the greatest tennis player the world has ever seen. And he then went into the rest of the season with that hanging over him. Maybe he was a step slower, he was a little bit more uncertain. He wasn't sure exactly how fast he was going to be, how good he was going to be. He went to the French Open, got absolutely destroyed in the final by Rafael Nadal. I mean, he lost, I think, third set, 6-love. It was brutal. And he went into the French Open with a new coach for Clay, who obviously did nothing whatsoever to help his game. There was nothing that Federer could do to stop the rampaging bull on the other end of the court, known as Rafa Nadal. It was not possible. He lost that final so badly. It still remains one of his most crushing defeats in a Grand Slam event ever. And then we came to Wimbledon, 2008. And it seemed like the old Federer was back. He was hitting the ball freely. He was, you know, just running straight through the opposition. He had a very easy time getting to the final. Didn't drop a set. Did extremely well. He just looked like the king of the grass courts, which is what he's always been. But the final was a totally different story altogether. It was white-knuckle, insanely technical, unbelievably ballsy, difficult tennis. I mean, neither man would give up. Federer was down 2-0. In the third set, he saved match point. He saved championship point with a single down-the-line backhand, which still, to this day, stands as one of the greatest shots ever executed. It was unbelievable that, you know, he produced such a clutch backhand at such a point in such a big match. And it was, you know, the match was interrupted by multiple rain delays. He was just not able to get his rhythm. Nadal was doing everything he could to hunt down every single shot. You know, there was nothing that he could do to break Nadal's will. And every time he was on serve, his own serve faced tremendous pressure. Every time he tried to fix mistakes in his game, Nadal just found another way to push him. And he did his best. He held back the tide as long as he could. And he did such a phenomenal job that it went into a fifth set. And not just a fifth set, but possibly the greatest fifth set, well, easily the greatest fifth set ever played. To this day, that match is still considered the greatest tennis match of all time, eclipsing even the previous kind of greatest match of all time, which was the 1980 final between John McEnroe and Bjorn Borg. Now, in that one, in the previous greatest of all time match, Borg won that match in the fourth set in one of the tightest fourth set encounters ever. This time, Federer, who is stylistically much more similar to Borg than McEnroe, Federer lost. And he lost because of an approach shot that he made, which normally, you know, 999 times out of 1,000, he would have made it and put it away, and he would have won, walked away the champion after that. But this time, he was down championship point. He ran up to the net. He was approaching the net. He hit a forehand, stuck in the net. It was heartbreaking. It destroyed him. You could see it. You could see how emotionally distraught he was afterwards. I mean, he took it like a man. He smiled to the cameras. He congratulated Nadal. He was incredibly magnanimous, incredibly gracious. But you could see it devastated him. And it affected him for a long time after that. He had just lost the keys to his kingdom on the biggest stage in the world. with tens of millions of people watching. He lost everything. And that is the nature of a champion's fall from grace. Suddenly, everything you have is taken away from you. You've got to find a way to recover it. Now, after a loss that devastating, and it was truly devastating, I mean, Federer was affected. He said it didn't really affect him that much afterwards, but the reality is it did. It crushed his spirit for a long time. And he said years later that match really made him more human, because prior to that, he was prone to making statements that showcased breathtaking arrogance. I mean, what most people don't realize is that Roger Federer, while he comes across as a very down-to-earth and quiet and relatable, just a really, really classy, nice guy, and he is. He is all of those things. He absolutely is. He's actually monumentally arrogant. He will say things, he has said things like, when people ask him, how is it that you have maintained this level of excellence for so long? He says, well, you know, just very talented, you know, just a very talented player, you know. And the thing is, he can get away with that kind of astonishing arrogance because he backs it up. There's nobody in his right mind who looks at the way Federer plays and compares him with previous greats of the game will ever say that Federer doesn't belong in that company. He really does. He is the most elegant, classy, classical player of the game that you will ever see. He would be perfectly at home no matter which era of tennis he played in. And his game is beautiful to watch. And on top of that, absolutely lethal. He has this combination, once in a 100, maybe 200 year ability to string versatility, accuracy, speed, power, and effortless grace together into one unique playing style. There's nobody else anywhere on earth who plays the way Federer does. There are players who come close, but they don't have his win record. They certainly don't have his longevity. So when somebody like that loses on that big a stage, it's a truly devastating loss. And Federer had a choice at that point. He could wallow in his misery, and he could say, oh, well, that's it. I'm never going to beat the all-time records. Because at the time, he was chasing Pete Sampras' record of 14 Grand Slams. He's now on 20, so he's gone way past. It seemed as though he would never beat that record. There were a lot of people saying, hey, you know what, maybe you should retire at this point. I mean, he was only 20, 27, 28 at the time. So, you know, today he's 38 and he's still getting to the finals of majors and still pushing the best in the world to and beyond the breaking point. That's how good he is. So the thought of Federer retiring just seems a bit ridiculous. But, you know, back then, even at the age of 28, people were saying, yeah, maybe you need to hang it up. Maybe these young guns, like 22, 23, you know, Djokovic was 22, Nadal was 23. They're doing better than you. They're beating you on the biggest stages. Maybe you should think about quitting. But he didn't quit. It wasn't in him. It isn't in him. Federer has a champion's heart and a champion's mind. And what that means is that not only did he take it on the chin and accept that he'd lost and accept his responsibility for his downfall, but he started to change things about his game. And you would see his game evolve over the next several years, to the point where if you look at his game today, while it looks on the surface very similar to his game from 10 years ago, in reality, he's tweaked a lot of things about it. He is much more aggressive about coming to the net and attacking the ball. He is much more technically sound on his weakest shots, which was always his backhand. His backhand was always a problem. But you know, in 2016, when he tweaked his knee and had to spend basically 6 months on the sidelines, he really spent the offseason working very, very hard on his game. And he changed. He fixed a lot of things that weren't going right. But he got out of that quicksand. He figured out how not to be trapped. And the only way to do that is to take a few moments, pause, reset, evaluate what's gone wrong, and say to yourself, okay, I own my mistakes. I own what happened to me. What do I do now? How do I fix it? How do I stop making these mistakes in future? That's what it takes, and it's a very painful process. Take it from me, I've been through it, and I'm still going through it. And it is a horribly painful, difficult, miserable process. But you have to do it, because that's the only way out of that quicksand. You have to face up to your fears. You have to face up to what's happened to you. You can't run away from it. And you have to say to yourself, okay, what's it going to take to get out from this? And then you have to do it. And you can't let anything stop you from getting that done. Now, for some men, it's easier said than done. I'll be honest about that. When you face certain obstacles in your life, and you know, if I have time, I'll get to some of those obstacles. There's nothing you can do about some of these things. You're stuck with them. Okay, so there's nothing you can do to change these things. But there, in terms of what you can do in times of true stress and times of true pain and misery is step back, evaluate, see what it is that has gone wrong. Immediately accept responsibility for what has happened. Immediately accept it that you weren't good enough, that you did something stupid, genuinely stupid. And then get on with the business of fixing yourself, making yourself better. As our friend, the gentleman adventurer, Adam Piggott, and he is a friend, I've been on his podcast before, he's a really cool guy. He doesn't have much to say about my taste in women, for whatever reason. I guess, he just has different tastes than I do, for whatever reason, like I said. As far as I'm concerned, I find hotter girls than he does, but anyway. As he pointed out, men do not find ourselves, we make ourselves. It's not enough to go on a journey of self-discovery. In fact, that's probably a waste of time. What you need to do instead is go on a journey of self-evaluation and figure out what it is that you want and figure out what it is that you are doing that's stopping you from getting what you want. And if you are facing truly hard times, then you need to face up to the reasons why you're stuck in those hard times. And you need to stop doing the stupid shit that you're doing so that you can fix what you're doing wrong and then start winning again. And I'll give you a couple more examples of this mindset that I'm talking about. If you look at Rich Franklin, he used to be the UFC's middleweight champion. So he used to fight at a couple of different weight classes. He fought in at light heavyweight, which maxes out at 205 pounds. And he had quite a few notable wins. I mean, really good wins over very, very good fighters. As I recall, I think he beat Randy Couture and did he beat Chuck Liddell? I forgot. I mean, you can go look up his record, but he was a tremendous fighter. And a very, very smart guy and really just a very likable dude. He's a very down-to-earth, very relaxed, chilled-out sort of guy. He has a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a master's degree in education. So this is not a stupid man. He's a very, very, very smart guy. And he has insanely high fight IQ. If you watch some of his fights, you realize very quickly that he is a very skilled, very dangerous guy. Extremely well-trained, really tough, has tremendous heart, knows how to fight, loves to fight, but has the spirit of a warrior within him. He doesn't just fight for the sake of inflicting pain. He fights for honor and glory and in line with the highest principles of the martial code. So he's just a really, really admirable dude. He got into the cage with Anderson Silva back when Anderson Silva had finally won his chance at a title shot and was utterly and totally destroyed by Anderson Silva's Muay Thai techniques, which involved grabbing and clinching with Rich Franklin, and they're just unleashing devastating knee attacks. One of the knees smashed into Rich Franklin's face and broke his nose at a truly horrifying angle. But if you watch Rich Franklin's post-fight interview, he's just completely classy. I mean, he just says, full credit to Anderson Silva. He beat me. I wasn't good enough. I didn't expect him to be so strong in the clinch, but he was. And I didn't do a good enough job of defending it. And he's the champion now, and good luck to him, and much respect. This is more or less what he said. He was given an instant rematch against Silva. Or maybe not an instant rematch, but he did get eventually a rematch against Anderson Silva. But it was the same story. Couldn't defend against the clinch. And for those of you who have trained in Muay Thai, or who have trained against Muay Thai fighters, you will know exactly why. The clinch in Muay Thai is used as a technique to stifle an opponent's ability to move, to restrict his movement completely, and then to just unleash knees and elbows from a close range. If you absorb a Muay Thai knee to the chest or the ribs, you're probably going to have breathing difficulties for a few days to a couple of weeks. It's very, very easy for guys who've taken those, you know, just unbelievably vicious knees to have cracked ribs and broken ribs because of how powerful those impacts and attacks really are. I know, I've trained in some of these techniques, they are truly devastating. So the reason why I bring up Rich Franklin's name is because he went from being at the top of the world to right back down to the bottom in space of a few minutes. It was just devastating for him. I mean, he had no answer for it. He tried to get out of the hole, and he tried to fix what had happened, but he couldn't. He wasn't good enough. He couldn't stop the quicksand. One mistake led to another. He eventually retired from fighting because he couldn't ever recapture the dominance that he had displayed for such a long time. He showed signs of his former skills and former glory, during his time in other weight divisions, but he just wasn't as good as he used to be. And it is sad because you watch the downfall of a truly great champion who was a true ambassador for the sport and just couldn't hold on to it, unfortunately. So he basically moved to a different division, but he wasn't really able to make much of an impact. I mean, if you look at his fight record, I'm just looking at it right now. He faced off against Chuck Liddell, and he did it. Faced off against various other true luminaries of the division. He beat Chuck Liddell, who is an amazing fighter. But then he lost against Forrest Griffin. He faced off against Wanderlei Silva, won that unanimously. But then he went back down to middleweight and faced off against Kung Lee in middleweight and lost against him. He was getting more and more fragile, because one of the problems of being a combat sports artist is that as you accumulate damage through your career, and Chuck Liddell is a classic example of this, the more damage you take, the harder it becomes to recover. Chuck Liddell used to have an absolutely iron chin. And then he got knocked out a few times. And once your brain endures, I'm going to say between 3 and 5 concussions, it just starts shutting down immediately. The moment that you just tap somebody on the chin, if you hit somebody hard enough on the chin, in fighting, it's called hitting somebody on the button. And the reason it's called that is because that is considered a very good way to just knock somebody out straight away. The reason is because the shock, or the hypothetical or the theory behind it, is that the shock of impact on the chin travels through vibrations straight through your jawbone to the base of your skull, which is where the spinal column meets the brainstem. And when that happens, the shock literally just short circuits your brain. Literally, that's what happens. It scrambles your brain around. What people don't realize is that, you know, if you look at a human skull, you think that it's all smooth and nice and oval shaped, but it's not. Inside the skull, on the inside, are lots and lots of bony, you know, tiny bony ridges and edges. And when your brain gets rattled around through hard impact, like at the end of a fist or a shin, then what's going to happen is your brain will bang into, because, you know, it's floating in a bed of fluid, it's going to bang into all of those corners and edges and ridges, and that's going to cause injury. It's going to cause problems. So when that happens repeatedly, your brain starts shutting itself down prematurely to stop yourself from taking any more damage. It just literally shuts down your body. And it's a defensive reaction saying, your body can't take anymore. You're under attack. You need to go limp. You need to just completely lose consciousness in order to stop the movement that is causing you this pain. And after a certain point, every fighter gets to the point where if he's taken enough brain damage, enough concussions, his brain is going to stop responding. And it's going to start shutting down the moment you get so much as tapped lightly. And that's exactly what happened to Chuck Liddell. That's probably what happened to Rich Franklin too. You know, he could see that his reactions were slowing down. He wasn't quite the fighter that he was. I mean, that's what happens when you take a knockout loss. It really messes with your head in fundamental ways. You never become the same guy that you were after a big loss. And you can look at any number of great fighters. You know, Anderson Silva experienced it. Chuck Liddell, of course. Luke Rockhold. Ronda Rousey. Who else? You know, you keep going on and on through the list. Wanderlei Silva, Mirko Krokop, Fyodor Emelianenko. Cody Garbrandt, for sure. TJ Dillashaw, we know, was doping, so you know, can't really say too much about that. But on and on and on through this. Henan Baral, of course, you know. All of these guys who were once utterly dominant champions, reduced to wrecks, hollow shells of their former selves by traumatic experiences. Some of them try to get back up and brush themselves off and continue fighting, and some of them do make it. But in the harsh world of combat sports, most of them fail, because that is the brutal reality of what they're doing. They can't get past the fact that they are in a profession that requires them to put their health on the line, and eventually it catches up with them. So with Rich Franklin, what happened was he accepted his losses with grace, and he accepted that he'd done things, he was no longer the best in the world. He was being outclassed by fighters who were better than him, who were younger than him, who could fight, who could really take more punishment than he could. So he chose to retire, and he went his merry way. And since then, he has really made a name for himself, you know, as a businessman, as a media personality, as a commentator. He did a great TEDx talk actually, in 2014, which was called How to Be a Loser. And he explained how he accepted and made peace with his loss. That is a tremendous admission and a really admirable one from a man who had everything and lost it in the space of, you know, a few minutes. That's an astonishingly humble and humbling thing to do. And he did it. And I have nothing but respect for a guy like that. Another great example that I could name, Dominic Cruz, you know. In my opinion, the finest bantamweight mixed martial artist ever. Just amazingly talented. I mean, he's completely unique in terms of his style, his footwork, his movement in the cage. He fights with his hands down, and he has this completely weird, awkward, you know, constantly shifting stances, way of moving, and his footwork patterns are completely bizarre to anybody who's trained in conventional fighting. He doesn't fight southpaw or orthodox. He changes his stance depending on what he feels like doing. If you watch him fight, his fight IQ is insane. He sees punches almost and kicks almost before they're thrown. He just moves out of the way. He just dodges them. He at one point, I think he held a statistical record for the fighter who absorbed the least number of hits out of anybody in any weight class. He was that good at just getting out of the way. And when he was fighting, he was just a force of nature. You couldn't stop him because he was not only technically brilliant, but he just couldn't get hit. So he dominated the bantamweight division for a long time. And then his long, long, long list of injuries started. He blew out his ACL. He had to get it replaced with a cadaver's ACL. Then his body rejected the cadaver's ACL, and he had to get it replaced with a tendon grafted from somewhere else on his body. That kept him out of the cage for like 3 years. Seriously, he was on the couch for 3 years, and he did a great interview with Toe Rogan. It is actually a really good interview, in which he talked about what he went through in order to deal with the psychological effect of going from the best in the world to retired couch potato in the space of a few months. You know, he lost it all. And he said that he was actually incredibly grateful for what he went through. He was grateful for his tests because he got to experience something that most fighters never get to experience. He got to experience in the peak of his career what it means to be retired. And he began to understand how to make peace with that, how to get away from this horrible feeling of depression that he had, which is unbelievably hard to do. I know, I've been there. So he made peace with himself instantly, got back on his feet, got back in the cage. You know, 3 years later, after he injured himself, he was back in the cage, tearing up the middleweight, the bantamweight division, beat the ever-loving snot out of, what was his name? Mizugaki. You know, really hot prospect, just completely destroyed him in the space of, I think, a single round. Then it turns out he injured his other leg in training. And this time when he injured it, he was like, I'm at peace. He wasn't angry or unhappy. He was just like, well, blew out my knee. Okay. But now I know what to do. Now I know how to fix this. He was on the couch for 9 months. And then he got back in the cage, started training, landed a title shot against TJ Dillashaw. Beat Dillashaw in an incredibly close split decision. In my opinion, he won that fight. Hands down, but you know, I'm not a judge. And he was on top of the bantamweight division for a while. You know, he was doing very well, defended the belt against Uriah Faber and settled a long-time beef with Faber himself. And then Cody Garbrandt came along and somehow everything that Dominic Cruz was doing no longer worked. Cody Garbrandt was showboating throughout that fight, and he made it clear that he had no respect for Cruz's skills, power, speed, anything. And he really took it to Dominic Cruz, really beat him up, and he won that decision. Dominic Cruz, let us remember, was fighting with years of accumulated damage. Both knees blown out, multiple injuries to his legs and knees and back and shoulders. He was fighting in the Dillashaw fight with plantar fasciitis, which meant that he couldn't walk, he couldn't move properly, and yet he still won that. But right after that fight, you know, didn't dodge the questions, didn't dodge the cameras, stood there in front of the world's media, took it like a man, said that, you know, I came, I was beaten by a better man tonight. I take responsibility for what I've done wrong. I'm going to go back in, I'm going to train, I'm going to be back. Now, that was a few years ago. We haven't seen him fight since then, because ever since then, he's just been getting injured repeatedly over and over and over again. The latest thing that happened to him, you know, just like a year back, was he broke his arm in training. So this is a guy who I don't think we'll ever see in the cage again. I hope we do, because I think he's an unbelievable fighter. But I don't think he's ever going to come back. He's now ranked the number 8 bantamweight in the world. But he's created a new life for himself. He's got his own career now doing color commentating for UFC fights. And he's a really great color commentator, because he brings an incredibly cerebral technician's perspective, because he himself is a technician. He's an unbelievably talented martial artist. So he sees things in ways that ordinary fight commentators would not be able to do. He's brilliant at breaking down techniques and tactics and strategies in the cage. He's brilliant at unpacking the mental chess that goes on inside the octagon. And he does a phenomenal job of explaining it all to even people who are just relatively casual fans of MMA, like me. You know, I'm not a hardcore, diehard fan. I don't watch every MMA match. I really don't. I just look at the highlights afterwards, and if I'm interested, I might watch some of the reels on YouTube and stuff like that. But beyond that, you know, I'm just not there. You know, it's whatever. Back in the day when I was living in the States, I just did not have the tolerance to stay up until 2 a.m. watching an MMA fight. Especially not given that Sunday was always my heavy lifting day. So I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. But, you know, I wasn't interested in paying that much for pay-per-view, and I just watched the highlight reels. But Dominic Cruz's commentary was always amazingly insightful. So he is a classic example of how you pick yourself up after a devastating loss and figure out how to move on. Because that's what you're going to have to do. And this brings me kind of full circle back to my own story. Those of you who have listened to my podcast before have heard me talk about it, how I lost my job in the U.S., third successive job loss, you know, every time I was laid off. And this time I didn't find another job and I had to leave. So in the space of about 20 minutes, I didn't know it at the time, but in the space of about 20 minutes, I lost everything, more or less. I lost my job. I lost my ability to stay in the USA. I lost my place in the, you know, miles-long line to get a green card. I lost a huge amount of mental health and well-being. I was in a profound depression. I didn't really think of it that way, but I was profoundly depressed for, I would say, 9 months. That's how long it took me to get to any kind of mental equilibrium. And it wasn't the end of my trials. It wasn't even close to the end 9 months later, because I kept getting barraged with just endless tests and endless things that I kept failing to do, lessons that I kept failing to learn. I was not adapting well to my new situation. I had to move back to the old country, which I hated, and I still hate it here. It's miserable being here, and maybe, you know, I might do a podcast on why it's miserable, because I think Americans might benefit from learning a little bit about another culture. But it was an extremely wrenching and difficult adjustment, and it's genuinely very hard for a man who's been living on his own for 12 years to come back and have to live under his parents' roof for over a year. You know, it's a miserable feeling. It means giving up a lot of independence, a lot of things that you like to do, and your own time, your own hobbies. You have to live in a city that you don't like. You have to live in a country that you don't like. You have to live with bad infrastructure, and you know, things just become exponentially more difficult. And on top of all of that, you know, every single job application I was sending out got rejected. Every single thing I was trying to do to get out of my situation either failed or made things worse. I was a horrible person to be around for a long, long time. And I won't go into the details of exactly how I stopped being such an asshole. I mean, I accept that I'm an asshole. I accept that I am a horrible, horrible person in a lot of ways. But that acceptance came at a cost. And I'm glad I paid that cost. You know, it was necessary. Because if I didn't pay it, if I had stuck to what I had been doing all along, I would have kept making the same mistakes. And while there is no end in sight for these tests that I am going through, at least not that I can see yet, the lessons that I have learned are very important and very powerful. Because once you internalize some of those lessons, you're not going to make the same mistakes again, and you're going to become much, much more dangerous in the process to those who would intend to do you harm. The first of those lessons is that you must always try to evaluate your weaknesses. And I don't mean in this in a hippy-dippy HR sort of way. I mean this in terms of a very hard-nosed, pragmatic approach. I'll give you a simple example. Where are most of your financial assets stored? Are they stored in a single country? Are they stored in the USA? Yes, well, then you've got a big problem. You need to diversify your portfolio because the United States of America is not immune to the laws of history. It will collapse. It will break apart. And when that happens, I don't care if you believe me or not, it's going to happen. When that happens, and it will happen in our lifetimes, it doesn't matter what the FDIC has insured your bank deposits for. The FDIC ain't going to bail out shit. Your bank deposits, your retirement plans, your pension plan, your 401k is going to evaporate into smoke. And there's not a damn thing you can do about it. Unless you realize that that is a massive point of fragility for you, and you start diversifying your holdings, you start opening up bank accounts overseas, you start depositing funds in those accounts, you start looking at investment opportunities overseas. In my case, my biggest area of fragility by far was the fact that I was tied to the US on an employment visa. If that had not been the case, if I had had a green card, it wouldn't have mattered what my employer wanted to do to me. I could have just said, okay, well, you know, up yours. Up your, take that up your jacksie, and walked away. And I would have been much more secure and also much more relaxed because I could have gone into a job interview. No, you know, hey, I've got all this money saved up. If this doesn't work out, that's okay. I'll just go look at the next job. Instead, I was under tremendous pressure to get something else, and I failed, partly because of that pressure. The next lesson you have to learn is that you need to accept your responsibility for your failures. If you screw up, you've got to take responsibility. You can't say, oh, well, you know, it's his fault, or it's that guy's fault, or it's my boss's fault. No. If you listen to my previous podcast, you'll know, you'll hear me talking about what it was that I did wrong. And it was me. It was my fault. I thought I was king shit of Turd Mountain, and I wasn't. And I found that lesson out very painfully. So when you are dependent on something, you need to know you need to know where your lifelines are. And if you only have one, well, don't abuse it. Don't fool around with it. Make sure that you treat it well, and make sure that you keep it well tended. Because if you lose it, you're not going to have another one. The third lesson is to make sure that when the hard times come, you have some sort of support system in place. Don't alienate the people who love you. Don't push them away. Because, trust me on this, you cannot win these battles by yourself. It's all very well for people in the manosphere to say, have a resilient mindset, be strong, be independent, be individualistic. Here's the reality. By yourself, you are easily destroyed. By yourself, you have nothing. I was by myself. I had nothing. I had no following, no support system, nothing that would stop me from being ground up and spat out. The same is not true when you have followers who support you, preferably monetarily. If not, fine. Spiritually is actually, that's a very good thing. People who pray for you and people who pray for your good health and well-being and for you to get out from the pain and misery that you're under. The moment that happens, you now have force multipliers. You now have the ability to be more effective with other people around you than just by yourself. I have nothing but contempt for the idea of teamwork, as a management fad. I think it's unbelievably stupid, because that is a true business school management fad. It's like, you need to do everything in teams. No, dude, things happen because individuals decide things aren't good the way they are, and I need to dedicate time and effort to improve things. But when you have followers who support you, then your individual efforts become multiplied 10 times or 100 times, and you become vastly more effective. And that's what you have to cultivate, is a following of people who will support you no matter what. And you've got to make the effort to make that happen. Whether that's your family, whether it's friends, whether it's Vox Day does with his dark streams, where he just rambles for an hour. And, he has an incredibly hardcore following. I'm one of them. Who will just support him no matter what he does. If he were to announce tomorrow, he's not going to do this, but if he were to announce tomorrow a plan to, burn down Antifa headquarters in Portland and impale people on spikes, again, he's not going to do this, and nobody freak out, but if he were to say that that's what he's going to do, don't be surprised when half or more of his followers, and he's got tens of thousands of them right now, say, I'm going to show up for that fight, and I can't wait to bring the marshmallows for the weenie roast. So, we are out of time, pretty much. I don't want to go over an hour, because ain't nobody got time for that. I hope you enjoyed this latest episode of Didactic Mind. Please hit the subscribe button if you have not done so already. Like and share if you enjoyed this one. And stop by my blog. The links are all in the description box. I look forward to reading your feedback. If you have questions or comments for me, leave them in the comment section either on SoundCloud or at my blog. And I will look forward to seeing you on the next one. Thank you.